This presentation is brought to you by Fried Hardeman University and is shared using a Creative Commons license, meaning some rights are reserved. For more, visit fhu.edu/lectureship.
Walk circumspectly. That surely includes looking back behind you, too. And as we begin this lectureship, we're taking a look back. I'm going to ask the dean of our Friends of the Restoration Movement. He's never heard that term before. John Ansel Jenkins, to lead us in a word of prayer. If you'll just stand where you are in just a moment, Brother John. We appreciate all his work and writing. And he helped us get this group together, Friends of the Restoration Movement. And we have invited Terry. I will introduce him in just a moment. But Brother John, stand please and lead us in a word of prayer as we begin. More about what some of the Friends participants have been doing, but if everyone will take note of the fact that we have a restoration trip June the 6th through the 12th, notices are up here at the front. See about those. Our topic today is Foy Wallace Jr. and Terry Gardner. Was born in Oklahoma, reared in Northern California, and since 1984 has been a Hoosier in the great state of Indiana. He graduated at Florida College, Western Kentucky University, earned a graduate degree from Indiana University School of Law at Indianapolis. The history of Churches of Christ has engaged his attention since an early age. He's got a biographical database on significant members of Churches of Christ that is now around 10,000 people. In addition to the many biographical essays he has written in periodicals and reference works, Terry Gardner has written a biography of Foy E. Wallace Jr. along with Noble Patterson, 1999, edited a new edition of Ligon's Portraiture of Gospel Preachers, 2000. He has worked with librarians, archivists, historians to identify, to collect, and to preserve many historically valuable documents and publications. He's also helping to prepare microfilm editions of Churches of Christ periodicals, including Christian Echo, Apostolic Times, Christian Crusader, and the Macedonian Call/Spiritual Call Journal. When several of us in the Friends group and others want to find some information, whether it's a less well-known person, we call Terry Gardner. That same afternoon or that same morning, you can have a lot of material coming across the line. We appreciate, Terry, your good work. His wife is here, yes, and I'm trying to retrieve her name.
Connie.
Connie. Thought I'd remember it. Connie, we're delighted to have you here with us this year. Ladies and gentlemen, Brother Terry Gardner.
How long do we have? 45 minutes.
I'm sorry, what does the next session? Someone has a brochure. 8:50. So we have about 45 minutes.
8:50. Well, we will we'll try to watch our time. Of course, as many of you know, Brother Wallace was famous for sometimes speaking fairly long sermons. There are a number of anecdotal stories about that, some true and some probably spurious. On one occasion, after he had preached a very, very long sermon, there was a sister at the back of the building, this was in Los Angeles, that was giving Brother Wallace some grief about such a long sermon. And Brother Wallace said, "Now, sister, they brought me out here all the way from Texas." And he said, "I want to be sure that I give people their money's worth. It's expensive, you know, to bring me that distance." And the sister said, "Thank God you're not from New York." So we will try to be cognizant of the time. You know, it's interesting. When you start to talk about things that you love, when you have a real passion for what you're discussing, it's easy to lose track of time. Some of us that are quite interested in history and have very long-suffering spouses can get quite wound up and spend lots and lots of time talking about the kinds of things that we are interested in. And certainly the same thing was true of Brother Wallace. To him, the most important message of all was the gospel message. And to him, when he would get so wrapped up, I think, oftentimes in what he was doing, that he just would forget the time. Now, sometimes when he would talk for fairly long amounts of time, he would remind people that as a young preacher, when he started preaching the gospel, which was in 1912, that typically meetings were 3 weeks long. You know, that was sort of a revelation to me when I was doing my research. I couldn't quite imagine a gospel meeting that was 3 weeks long. Well, then I found out that they would have services twice a day, except on Sunday, of course, where they would have services three times, or a holiday like Thanksgiving. They thought Thanksgiving meant giving thanks, not watching football. And so they would have three services on Thanksgiving. In 1921, this is a short article that appeared from the pen of Brother Wallace in the Gospel Advocate. And this was just as the new year was about to dawn. He said, "We're standing on the threshold of a new year. Another milestone on life's road has been passed. Another page in life's book has been written. We face new problems, feel the weight of grave responsibilities. The world is rank with sectarianism and infidelity in various forms, as a wolf in sheep's clothing is crouching at our door. Brethren, we must have concerted action and unrelenting zeal if we would save the day for Christ and His true church. As a preacher, I pledge you my loyalty to the plain, simple, positive New Testament gospel, to its method of work and system of worship, and resolve to declare the whole counsel of God with more zeal and fervor than ever before. As a member of the one body, will you not pledge unceasing cooperation in the task ahead? Resolve to attend every service of the church in summer or in winter, or in prosperity or adversity. Son, go work today in my vineyard is the call to every disciple of the Lord. Will you go? Here is my hand, with firm confidence in God and the right and the unswerving fidelity to our great cause. Let us renew our strength, remember our King, and hold fast our boasted confession, unshaken to the end." Foy Wallace, Jr., Gospel Advocate, January 1921. Brother Wallace was 25 years old. His results for 1921, 18 meetings held, 281 baptized, 90 restored. His song leader in every one of those meetings was Tilda S. Tedley. Many of you will know Brother Tedley from songs like "Worthy Art Thou" and a number of other songs. Well, that tells us a little bit about the character of Brother Wallace. What I'd like to do today, this is going to be a different lecture than the one that I gave at Faulkner in February. There's going to be some overlap, of course. But I want to kind of focus on what it was that made Brother Wallace a person of influence. How is it that he was able to do what he did? When you look at his life, and I think what we'll do is just sort of take a brief review of his life, We'll take a look at some of the issues that he influenced, and then we're going to try to answer this question of what was there about him that permitted him to be such a person of tremendous influence. And we'll sort of start. This is a photograph of Brother Wallace, by the way, that was taken by Max Crumley, Jr. This is the grandson of J.W. Crumley, and Max Crumley, Sr. was a very fine gospel preacher in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Area. Childhood photos, and what we have here is the Wallace children. This is Foy's older brother, Cled, and this is Foy, probably at about age 2 or 3 years of age. They were the children of a gospel preacher whose name was Foy Wallace, Sr. Brother Wallace, Sr. was a very popular preacher in the state of Texas. This is the family a little bit older. And again, you can see here's Foy Wallace, Jr., probably at about 15. His older brother, Cled, who was 19 years of age. Foy used to quip sometimes that he and Cled were only distantly related. So the distance was about 5 years between the two. Cled would sometimes quip that they were distantly related as there were two girls between them. Now, those two girls were Willie Wallace, who, interestingly enough, wrote a commentary on the book of Revelation, and she was married to Dean Speck of Abilene Christian College, and then the other sister was Tempe. So this is Tempe, Willie, Cled, and Foy Jr. This is a photograph of Foy when he's a student at Thorpe Spring Christian College. This was about 1912. And really, when you think about his education, he didn't have a lot of education. He had his education in the common schools of Texas. He had his education from his parents. He was educated by other preachers. C.R. Nicol and R.L. Whiteside were both extraordinarily close to the Wallace family. And so Foy begins to preach at about this age. And his sum total of college is two semesters at Thorpe Spring Christian College. We probably wouldn't think of Thorpe Spring as even a decent high school, you know, by today's standards. So when you begin to think about the work that Brother Wallace does or sometimes tries to do in dealing with issues and problems, not only in the church but also with colleges, which do come up from time to time, sometimes that the folks that Wallace was trying to reach out to would be rather frustrated. You know, it's interesting, N.B. Hardiman himself writes a letter to B.C. Goodpasture where he's frustrated with the amount of influence that Foy Wallace is exercising over the Christian colleges, including Freed Hardeman University. And he says he's only got a year of college. Well, you know, this was at a point where Brother Wallace and Brother Hardiman were a little bit on the outs. You know, there were challenges and all that. So sometimes even his contemporaries, I think, are somewhat mystified by the amount of influence and his ability to make things happen, good, bad, or indifferent. This is Foy as he really begins to preach. He starts in 1912. He was born in 1896 in Montague County, Texas. Brother Wallace used to say that he was born in a cotton patch, but that didn't make him a bale of hay. You know, he was quite often trying to use that sort of humor throughout. This is Brother Wallace with S.H. Hall. This is Brother Hall right here. And Austin Taylor, his great song leader. Probably Brother Taylor's best-known song was Do All in the Name of the Lord. And this is Brother Wallace. This is from a gospel meeting held in Russell Street in Nashville, Tennessee. This was his second meeting in Russell Street. His first meeting there was held in 1923. Now, I think one of the things we have to know and understand Brother Wallace's influence, was that right from the get-go, he's really primarily an evangelist. He's out sharing the good news. He's holding gospel meetings wherever he can go. He goes into poor towns. He goes into rich towns. He goes into towns where there is no church, and he preaches the gospel, and he does this for 18 years. 18 years. The meetings that he holds at Russell Street were just, you know, were unbelievable in their impact. And as you see his career develop through the teens and the 1920s, he'll go into a town, and it was not unusual in a few places to baptize as many as 100 people in a single meeting. Austin Taylor, who's to Brother Wallace's right, said this. He said, Foy Wallace, Jr. and I have blazed the trail throughout 8 different states, In a few places, there have been more than 100 people baptized while I stood by singing, "O Happy Day." In the summer of 1920, in a meeting at Lomita, Texas, he baptized 100 people, and Brother Wallace wrote, "No one under 16 years of age in the number." George Klingman wrote to Brother Wallace in 1920 that he studies his Bible carefully, speaks in an attractive and pleasing manner with a distinct message based on a strong conviction in God and His holy word. His appeals to the unconverted are irresistible. 41 were baptized in that particular meeting. Well, that takes us into this first meeting to the east of the Mississippi, Russell Street. Well, Russell Street was a very influential congregation. There were two extraordinarily well-known members of the church that were a part of that congregation. One was J.C. McQuitty. Brother McQuitty owned the Gospel Advocate. The other individual was E.G. Sewell, who had been the editor of the Gospel Advocate and David Lipscomb's co-laborer for more than 50 years. So here's Brother Wallace in 1923, basically a 26-year-old kid preacher, and he's holding his first meeting there. And here's what S.H. Hall wrote about the meeting. He said, "This is the only revival I've ever been in, that it seemed the crowds hindered the work. It was estimated that some 600 or 1,000 were turned away for lack of room. The house was packed at the last three services, the last day of the meeting." Here we are, three services in one day, packed every service. "And at the final night service, it was considered that more than 2,000 were in the building and hundreds turned away." That's a fairly effective evangelist. And it's somebody who has developed the ability to move people and to do so quite dynamically. 1927, Brother Wallace was called to hold a meeting at the Central Church of Christ in Los Angeles, California. The meeting was very successful. This is a meeting card from that meeting, basically a postcard. Many of you are old enough to remember when this is one of the primary ways that gospel meetings were advertised. So this is a copy of the meeting card from Los Angeles in 1927. That meeting was quite successful, and in 1928, the Wallace family moved to Los Angeles, California. And Brother Wallace did really his only true local work in Los Angeles, which he did from 27 until 1930. They would go back east to hold meetings, even while living in California. This is kind of one of my favorite pictures, and I like to point out that I throw this one in there for the attorneys. You know, it was mentioned that I have a law degree. Definitely looks like a lawsuit waiting to happen. What you have over here is Moccasin Bend, the Tennessee River. Many of you will recognize this as Rock City, which you're still encouraged to see, but you're not allowed to climb on the rocks like the family did. And you can see here's Brother Wallace. Here's his oldest daughter, Leella, who by the way, Leella is still living, 92 years old, and is a good friend of mine, and other members of the family. There's Virgie, I think this is William, Wilson Wallace, etc. Now, in 1930, Foy Wallace Jr. is summoned by wire by Leon B. McQuitty to become the editor of the Gospel Advocate. This is a time when there is no such thing as television. The printed medium is still tremendously influential. Even radio is very new. Radio's really just started to get going about 1924, 25. And, of course, David Lipscomb had been the editor of the Gospel Advocate until his death in 1917, and then Brother Sewell had died in 1924. Now, you might ask yourself, you know, if you wanted to be the editor of the Gospel Advocate, what would you do? You know, how would you politically, and I'm not using that in a bad sense, but, you know, in terms of preparing yourself and doing the right things and building the right, what would you do to become the editor of the Gospel Advocate? Well, you know, one thought would be you'd want to write a lot of really good articles. And so the first question is, well, did Brother Wallace write a lot of really good articles before 1930? And the answer is no, he didn't. Maybe 10 or 12 articles at the most. Well, if you didn't write a lot of really good articles, maybe you'd want to be famous as just a tremendously dynamic debater. Maybe Brother Wallace had 100 debates by 1930 when he was 33 years old. And the answer is no, he didn't hold a lot of debates. He'd had two debates. And this is in an era where it wasn't unusual for a good debater to hold 100 debates by the time he was 34 years old. So he didn't do that. Well, maybe you would just develop a great political network. Well, if you know anything about Brother Wallace, that wasn't in his nature. He would call it like he saw it, whether people liked it or not, whether he was right or wrong, and whether it was it was good, bad, or indifferent. He didn't do any of those things. Now, you might ask yourself, if you really wanted to be editor of the Gospel Advocate, and all of a sudden, here comes Brother Wallace, never having edited a paper, never having owned a paper, having written very few articles, not being a debater, really known for one thing, his evangelistic efforts. It tells you something, doesn't it, about Brother Wallace and the kind of person that he was. And what a lot of this has to do with, you know, there are certain things where I'm going to talk about Brother Wallace's ability to influence people, where there are things that you could do. There's other things that there's just things that you can't do, right? You know, sometimes they'll talk about people having an imitable style. He had charisma. And there was something about Brother Wallace that when people met him, they fell in love with him. And especially in the early days, right? He's not a controversialist. So you go in this very early period of his life, the first 18 years as an evangelist, he doesn't have any enemies, either in the church or outside, because really all he's been doing is preaching the gospel. And so it's sort of an interesting thing, you know, when you think about it. And you can imagine that some of the folks in Nashville were less than happy to have a Texan who was 33 years old, who seemed to them to be totally unqualified, and who frankly didn't hold a lot of David Lipscomb's views. He did not hold the same view David Lipscomb held, for example, on civil government. In 1930, Brother Wallace's position was the non-combatant position. Later, he changed that view. And obviously, on the issue of rebaptism, or whether it was essential to understand that baptism was for the remission of sins, you know, he didn't agree with David Lipscomb on that. And you could talk about some other things kind of along the same line. There were people in Nashville, believe me, who were puzzled. There were people in Nashville who were jealous. And there were people in Nashville, frankly, who were probably more than a little bit unhappy that Brother Wallace got selected to be the editor of the Gospel Advocate. But this is the first article that he ever wrote for the Advocate. The title of this article is An Open Door. Well, during this four-year period for which he's editor of the Gospel Advocate, he continues to hold meetings. This is Basil Doran. Some of you, particularly from this part of the country, probably remember Basil's brother Adrian fairly well. Basil was a great song leader, had a tremendous voice, and for several years he went with Brother Wallace holding meetings. So Brother Wallace continued to hold meetings. In 1934, Brother Wallace resigned as the editor of the Gospel Advocate. He was suffering from financial difficulties. They were in the middle of the Great Depression. They had a number of medical emergencies. Brother Wallace himself was in severe need of an operation in 1934. He didn't have the money to have that operation performed. You know, there's been a lot said in the healthcare debate of the last couple of years. Go back before World War II, there isn't such a thing as health insurance. And so, you know, one bad medical situation could very easily wipe you out. So he was in very difficult financial straits. And in October of 34, after having resigned as the editor of the Gospel Advocate, Brother Wallace declared bankruptcy while affirming his debts. This is one of those decisions that, you know, followed Brother Wallace for the rest of his life. His enemies quite often would use the fact that he had declared bankruptcy to attack him. In 1937, with the help of J.W. Aiken, for whom the Aiken Fund is named, which was a fund that Brother Aiken established here at Fried-Hardeman University, he went back and paid off all of those debts. He then, in 1935, began a magazine, and that magazine was called The Gospel Guardian. This is one of the issues of that particular paper. It was a monthly. There are only a total of 8 issues of the paper that appeared, 9 numbers. There was one double number. And then in 1936, he became the front page writer for the Firm Foundation, which he did for about a year and a half. And then following that, started the Bible Banner, which ran for 11 years. Most of the time, it ran as a monthly. You know, during this period of his life, from 1930 through about 1950, Brother Wallace becomes very much a controversialist. The man who hadn't had any debates had probably 10 debates, and many of those debates were with major public figures. One of the best-known debates that Brother Wallace had was in 1934 with a man named J. Frank Norris. It's a little bit hard, you know, to really explain to this sort of an audience the huge public figure that J. Frank Norris really was. But let me try to put it like this. Think about the popularity and influence of Billy Graham, of Louis Farrakhan, and Jesse Jackson, and combine those now into all into one guy. And you've got J. Frank Norris. When J. Frank Norris called the President of the United States, President Roosevelt took his call. When J. Frank Norris goes to England in the middle of World War II, Winston Churchill takes 2 hours out of his day to visit with J. Frank Norris. 1926, an unarmed man came to J. Frank Norris's office. J. Frank Norris pulled his gun out and shot him to death. Preached the very next day, which was Sunday. And when a reporter is grilling him about this, I mean, and she's asking tough questions. How could you preach, you know, with his body unburied? Norris, without hesitation, says, "Well, friend, you know, when you're in trouble, don't you want to be with your family?" He had a way of disarming people. Well, 1934, Wallace debates J. Frank Norris. So here's Wallace, basically this, in relative terms, in terms of the world order, unknown person to the world at large. He goes and debates J. Frank Norris. 6,000 people attend the debate. J. Frank Norris had several debates with preachers for Churches of Christ. He never permitted the speeches that had to do with baptism to be printed. And I think the reason is he knew that he hadn't done well in those areas. You know, one of the stories Brother Wallace would tell about that debate was they were talking about Mark 16:16. "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned." And J. Frank Norris made this argument. He said, "Well, Brother Wallace, it's like this." He said, "Whoever gets on the train and is seated will get to Chicago. Getting on the train is essential, but whether you're seated or not is incidental." Well, Brother Wallace, of course, could have done what a lot of us would do, point out that that was grammatically incorrect and so on and so forth. He didn't do any of that. When he stood up, he said, "Now, friend Norris," he said, "what you Baptists teach is the minute that you believe you are saved. So the second you get on the train, you're in Chicago, you don't have time to sit down." Well, that was how those things went. So in this second phase of Brother Wallace's life, he becomes very much a controversialist. He's careful in terms of who he debates. He never has a lot of debates. But he does deal really primarily with about four issues, and I'm just going to very briefly set those before you. The first issue, of course, was premillennialism. He begins to deal with that fairly early in his editorship with the Gospel Advocate, I think highly encouraged by F.B. Shrigley, who was the senior editor of the Advocate at that time. Premillennialism had been a problem in the church going all the way back to 1915, 1916. A man named R.H. Bowl had been the front page editor of the Advocate from 1909 until 1915. And because of his speculative pronouncements, J.C. McQuitty had fired him not once but twice. Fired him, and then he believed that Brother Bowl had promised not to feature speculative teaching. And then he put him back on the Advocate, and in no time at all, Brother Bowl was back at it. So that was one of the issues that Brother Wallace is probably best known for. He was dealing with the issues, you know, of the premillennialist and whether the church was really an accident or an essential part of the plan of God. And he took a tremendous amount of abuse for taking the lead in that area. And this is a person who really was genuinely a very, you know, at his core, a very sensitive sort of person. So you take that kind of a person, you put yourself in a situation where you're facing that kind of abuse. It was very, very challenging. The second major issue had to do with civil government. When the Second World War began, the Bible Banner is really one of the few major publications for the Churches of Christ, not the only one, but one of the few, that took the position that Christians could participate in all phases of civil government, including serving as policemen, serving as combat soldiers, basically serving as any way. Well, this was a change in Brother Wallace's position. His father, Foy Wallace Sr., had been an advocate of the non-combatant position. Brother Wallace's youngest brother, Tom Wallace, who's also still living, when World War II began, also took the non-combatant position. But not too long after the war began, Tom also accepted the view that Christians could participate in combat, and he flew 25 missions over Germany. Nevertheless, there were a lot of people that were quite offended that Brother Wallace had changed his position. and aided by his brother Cled Wallace, R.L. Whiteside, and C.R. Nickel, argued, as strongly as I think it's possible to argue, that Christians could be involved in civil government. And, of course, basically arguing from Romans chapter 13, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. And so the view was that when civil government did what it was supposed to do in a lawful way, and it was using the sword, it wasn't using the sword in vain, that the government had the right to defend itself. And if the government had no right to defend itself, it had no right to exist. And so that fight was waged through the Bible banner, and that fight, as with all fights, garnered Brother Wallace some more enemies. 1947, that the third major fight that Brother Wallace was involved in, he was involved in with N.B. Hardiman. And it had to do with whether churches had a right to put the school in the church budget. Brother Wallace objected to it. He thought Brother Hardiman had always objected to it. And Brother Hardiman and Brother Wallace, the best way to put it is they got into quite a melee. And it was a fight that became so bitter that both men later regretted it as sort of the nadir, the absolute low point of both of their lives. And I believe that the matter was resolved before Brother Hardiman passed away. The kind of last issue that Brother Wallace is often associated with is the issue that has to do with what's sometimes called institutionalism. And what I want to stress, I guess, primarily about that is anyone that studied Brother Wallace's life knows that Brother Wallace was not in favor of the position taken ultimately by the non-institutional brethren. Brother Wallace also, though, felt that quite often there was a lot of scheming that was going on, and that more was being done than should have been done, and so he objected to that. And I'll just sort of, I think this kind of fairly sums up his view of institutionalism. He says, in this free-for-all melee, the discussions have descended to arguing the latest whims of the disputants. This is a war of words which demoralizes the church within and degrades it without. It has become a ridiculous caricature of the polemics of Christianity. It presents a sordid spectacle. It is a sorry concept of defending the faith and advancing the cause of Christ. Consider the ignominious exhibitions of public debates between brethren on whether it is scriptural for a congregation to perform a humanitarian service to someone not a member of the church, or whether it is right for an able church to help a weak one maintain a preacher among them. And to make such whims the wedge of division in congregations to the confusion of the members. Such forensic episodes are not ameliorating to the disturbed state of the churches generally, and cannot be the solution to any crisis that exists in congregations locally. Of these things, put them in remembrance, charging them before the Lord that they strive not about words to no profit, but to the subverting of them that hear them. And I think that gives you a little bit of a kind of a brief flavor for some of the controversies that Brother Wallace was involved in. Brother Wallace did use notes in his preaching, not in the way that we would ordinarily think of those notes. He typically would make his notes in advance, study the lesson carefully, and basically he'd memorize the notes and would not use them during the sermon itself, but they do exist. This is from the Louisville meeting in 1950, held in Louisville, Kentucky. Brother Wallace, the song leader, is a very close friend of mine. This is George Tipps. I kid George that in this picture he looks like he just got out of day camp. But that is 61 years ago, which seems kind of amazing. Some of the men, again, that Brother Wallace associated with, this is Austin Taylor, J. Early Arsenault. And then this is a photograph of an appreciation dinner that was held right here at Freed Hardeman in 1966. One of the speakers at that meeting was B.C. Goodpasture. And I thought I might, as I kind of move to this phase of trying to look at Brother Wallace's influence, just share a little bit that Goodpasture had to say at that meeting. I guess I should also point out, since he just passed away, this is Brother Earl West right here in the background. He just passed away last week, and more will be said about him a little bit later in our meeting. Let's see here. This is Brother Goodpasture. Most of you probably know that. Of course, Brother Wallace and Sister Wallace. I think this is B.B. James, if I'm not mistaken. L.N. Moody, just to kind of give you some of the folks. There's H.N. Dixon. All right, here's what B.C. Goodpasture said. Now, again, I want to keep this in some context. Brother Wallace had been good friends with Brother Goodpasture, but they'd also mixed it up in the papers. And they had some rather harsh exchanges at one point in time. So this is B.C. Goodpasture on Foy Wallace, Jr. He said, Brother Wallace is a vigorous writer. He's strong. His language is vigorous. Brother Wallace has punch in his writing. In fact, I know. I've been on the receiving end sometimes. I know what he can do. I know that he can do the job. I'm reminded here of what Henry Grady said, speaking up in New England shortly after the Civil War. Speaking at a New England dinner, he said, we people down south respect General Sherman, but he said, we do think he's a little careless with fire. Brother Wallace has written what he believes. You know, I like to hear a man preach who preaches what he believes. David Hume used to hear old John Brown preach. Someone asked him why. Said, why do you go hear that old man preach? Well, he said, I don't believe much that the old man says. But he said, the old man himself believes it, and I like to hear a man preach who believes what he's preaching. That's one thing about Brother Wallace and his writing that I like, among many things. He writes what he believes, and he believes the Bible. He believes the Bible came from God, inspired in word and in thought, fully inspired. I like a man who believes and teaches God's word, as indeed and in truth it is the word of the Lord. A couple of other slides here just to pass over quickly. This is Brother Wallace and my friend Noble Patterson. Brother Patterson, by the way, just celebrated his 87th birthday. Some of Brother Wallace's books, and then Into the Sunset. All right, with that kind of preamble, we'll touch briefly then, I think, in the next 10 minutes, on some of the things that had to do with Brother Wallace and his influence. What was it about him that made him such a person of influence? And I don't know how many of these we'll get through, but we'll pick a few. The first one I want to suggest is this. He encouraged people to think for themselves. Some of Brother Wallace's critics have tried to suggest that you had to agree with Brother Wallace on everything. Well, that's simply not the case. Both Hugo McCord and E.G. Creasy were pacifists when this issue over civil government became hot during the Second World War. Brother Wallace argued with force and effect that Christians could serve as police officers and combat soldiers. But he wasn't intolerant of his friends' views, and he remained close to both Brother McCord and to E.G. Creasy. Brother Wallace's view on the Holy Spirit was somewhat different from Hugo McCord's, but this is what Hugo McCord wrote about Foy Wallace in 1966. He said, for a third of a century, I've gone near and far to be close to Foy Wallace, Jr. If ever a man were gifted with five talents in mental strength and quick thinking with a big and warm heart, it's Foy Wallace, Jr. At Crawfordsville, Indiana, in the early 30s, it was Foy Wallace who took an interest in me as a young preacher. And his interest in me made me feel as if I were on a mountaintop. At Chattanooga, he took me and my wife to his family's quarters on Signal Mountain and encouraged me to write. Not accidentally, my paths have crossed his in many states, and I'm always stronger and better because of such contacts. On one occasion, after I had driven 450 miles, I mean, how many people would you drive 450 miles to, you know, to go here? 450 miles to Washington, North Carolina to hear him preach. He got up and announced that I would do the preaching. And he sat down. Embarrassing as this was to me and unfair to the audience, but still it encouraged me. He's one of the unforgettable men of God in my life, always clean morally. When he married, it was to one woman for keeps. And her he has loved more than he loves himself. He loves with a big, warm heart. He grieves just as deeply when men defect from the faith. He loves the truth of the gospel more than he loves any human being. Many men can look over him physically, if you notice that picture of him with Noble Patterson, but spiritually, nobody stands higher. Well, here's one of the keys to his influence. He took the time to encourage people, to help people, to do everything that he could for folks. And you think about how busy, you know, we all are. It's the 21st century. There's a zillion things going on. There's the internet. There's texting. There's old issues of the Christian Journal you could be reading instead of listening to me. It's difficult. It's challenging to focus on helping people. He was able to do that. Second thing that I find in Brother Wallace's life was he was especially kind to young preachers. Earl West told me once, he said, Terry, he said, when Brother Wallace would come to town, we would get in my car and we would go to the used bookstores in Cincinnati, which is about 100 miles from Indianapolis. And he said, Brother Wallace would treat me as his equal while acting as my patron. He said, he paid for everything. He paid for the gas. He paid for the books we bought. He paid for the meals. He goes, there was never another preacher that did that. Never another preacher that did that. So he was very kind to young preachers. So when I was here at the Freed Hardeman Lectures back in 1998, David Reeves came to me, and one of the things he shared with me was he said, Terry, back in the mid-50s, I was really struggling with this issue, and I shared it with Brother Wallace. And he said, the next day, he said, I had a 20-page manuscript from Brother Wallace to answer my questions. Third thing that I think made him a person of influence, he was an independent spirit. People loved that about him, and it also drove him absolutely crazy. It was both a blessing and it was a curse. But it's a part of why he was influential. Nobody could tell him what to preach. Nobody could tell him how to preach. Nobody could tell him where to preach. And a few people made that mistake. He was often encouraged to ease up on the excesses of various problems that he saw, and he wouldn't do it. Well, you know, this is a challenge, right? We live in a politically correct age. Years ago, when I was up in Smiths Grove, Kentucky, I can remember one of the old brethren coming back, and he said, you know, it's important to preach the truth and to preach hard. He said, you know, he said, I can remember this story being told many years ago of the preacher that went up to Louisville, Kentucky, to hold a meeting. And he said, the preacher got up there, and the first day, he just wailed away on the evils of tobacco. And after the service was over, one of the elders grabbed him and said, you know, we have a lot of the brethren here working the tobacco business. It'd be better if you laid off on that. Well, the next night, he was on the evils of gambling. And, of course, somebody pulled him aside and said, you know, Churchill Downs, you know, a lot of the brethren are involved in the gambling business. If you could go, the meeting will go better if you'll lay off that. And so then he waxed eloquent on the evils of strong drink. And, of course, they pointed out that we've got the distilleries here. It would be better if you kind of laid off that. So the poor preacher was totally frustrated and said, what in the world can I preach on? And the elder pondered for a second and said, well, you might preach against witch doctors. There ain't one of them in 500 miles. Well, Brother Wallace was not that kind of a preacher or speaker. He was going to deal with whatever the issues were. And he didn't worry about the consequences. It didn't matter to him what happened. The fourth thing was his certitude of belief. The fact that he knew whom he believed in. He believed the gospel of Jesus Christ. He believed that the Bible was all-sufficient. And he wasn't particularly interested in theology except in its broadest sense. He certainly didn't have a problem with reading books of theology. But at his 70th birthday, he made a kind of a remarkable statement, which I'm going to see if I can find here. And in this statement, he was just dealing with this whole issue as it pertained to theology. I may not be able to find it immediately to hand. I will try to summarize. Basically, what he said was this. He said that what we need to be preaching as preachers of the gospel is the Bible. And he said if Christian colleges are simply going to parrot the theology from Harvard Divinity School and from Yale and from Chicago and from Lexington Cemetery, he says the church would be better off to simply send the young preachers straight to those places to get it direct. Right? That's the sort of certitude of belief that he had. Notwithstanding the certitude of belief, though, the next thing that made him a person of influence was when convinced he was wrong, he would change. Now, some people would say he wasn't the easiest guy to convince he was wrong, but he was convinced that he was wrong on a number of occasions, and he wasn't hesitant to write. When he was convinced, he would write a letter of apology. He would do whatever he could to make that situation right. A lot of preachers have a hard time doing that. The next element that I want to touch on briefly was just his incredible generosity. Foy's wife, Virgie, shortly after her husband died, said this. She said, Foy would rather do without and help a friend than anything in the world. You know, we often sing songs like, "This world's not my home, I'm just passing through." But how many of us really believe that? I mean, how many of us really have laid our treasures up in heaven and we're not worried about what's here? How many of us are really ready to go be with the Lord today? And I think there was a part of Brother Wallace's personality that was tremendously influential, because that was truly the way that he lived. He lived kind of as a vagabond, quite often not having a home. Those who were suffering financial hardships, he had a tender spot in his heart for. Brother Tedley and his family lived with the Wallaces for a year when they were down on their luck. Walter Brightwell, who later becomes the news editor of the Gospel Advocate, had inherited some money from his family, loses it all in the Depression. 1933, Brother Wallace invites the Brightwell family to Nashville, gets Walter a job at the Gospel Advocate, and the Brightwells live with the Wallaces for a year. And I could, you know, I could go kind of on and on. John Bannister, a preacher that some of you will remember, needed a hernia operation in the 1940s, which was both a painful, very painful at that time, and expensive procedure. Well, Brother Wallace found out about it and said, "Scott and White's the only place for you." He arranged for the surgery to be paid for. The day before Brother Bannister was supposed to go, Brother Wallace called John Bannister up and said, "I'm going that way anyway. I'm going to come and get you and your wife." Drove them to the Scott and White clinic, stayed with him for all the preliminary testing. When John Bannister woke up, there was Foy Wallace Jr. sitting in the hospital room, and he stayed with them until they were ready to go back to Oklahoma, and drove them back. And I could tell many, many, many stories along that line. The last thing that I'll mention is his pastoral side, and I think that's really sort of well summed up. This is a letter, and I'll close with this. This is a letter that was written by Foy Wallace to a brother and sister Miller, Raymond Miller of Billings, Montana. And it illustrates, you know, I think something rather interesting about Brother Wallace. Brother Miller had been married and divorced very early in life, been very briefly married for six months or maybe a year. He remarries, and the person that he remarries and he both became Christians, had been married for 40 years, had children. Well, Brother Miller became very concerned. Well, you know, was his marriage valid? Should the preacher have asked him about his marriage? And regardless of your position on this particular issue, is not so much the point as it is to show the kind of letter that he writes to the Millers. He wrote to Brother Wallace, and in writing to Brother Wallace, he had a question mark. "Dear Brother, Wallace." He's not even sure he's a Christian. And so here's Foy's response. He said, "Dear Brother and Sister Miller, first you may erase the question mark after brother in addressing me and after in Christ in your signature, for I accept you as Brother Miller, my brother in Christ. Second, in your letter you fairly answered your questions to me quite correctly. The Lord did not prescribe any such action which a preacher referred to would bind, nor did his apostles do so in epistles to the churches in dealing with such past conditions. Restitution for sins is required only when and where restitution is possible. This is not possible in the classification of sins that are past, Romans 3:25. The incidents in your life in the far past is outside restitution, but is within the remission of sins. And a preacher who makes it mandatory now for you to break up your home, separate from your family, and thus scandalize your children and destroy them is legislating his own opinions, and there is no scripture for that course of action. And it's very doubtful that in the same circumstances he would do so himself. My advice and counsel to you, as it has always been to others in like circumstances, is to stay with your family, live right, be Christians, bring your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord in the church, and strive to go to heaven, as all of us, as full of mistakes as we are, should strive to do. In my commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, there is a section which deals with this portion of the Lord's teaching. I've marked the enclosed folder. It was a pleasure to have you in the meeting at Roanoke, Texas. I would be happy if such a thing would occur again." So there you go. Hopefully it adds something to your knowledge of Brother Wallace. He was not certainly a perfect man, but I think that he sort of well says this business of striving to go to heaven, as full of mistakes as all of we are. I think that was his main goal, and in doing that, I believe that he led at least 10,000 souls to Christ. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Terry, for your preparation and presentation this morning. Let's take a five-minute break, and we'll get started in 5 minutes on the next session.
What relationship with the other boy, E. Wallace, Jr.? But isn't it interesting that Brother Tedley ended up...